Afternoon with overlapping committees with many of our same members, and several of our members are in another committee that hasn't completed its work, and some of us were here overlapping with our time as well. But we aren't going to be taking any action today, but we are having the department come and present to us their a discussion of the No Child Left Behind waiver request and the status and anything that we can understand about that, because I think we've been talking about it. We need to understand how it interfaces with our statutes and positions, and this is an opportunity to have that kind of discussion. So I would invite whoever is going to be here from the department to come to the table, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessie Montano. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. I want to thank you today for inviting us here and to have the opportunity to give you an update on the waiver request that we have. It is something that we are very excited about and have spent a lot of time putting the information together. We have invited numerous stakeholders to provide input into the process during the development of the waiver. Once the waiver was submitted, we also had an opportunity for input and traveled throughout the state and have met with superintendents and different ed organizations, as well as many districts and communities. And we're receiving very positive feedback on some of the provisions and components of the waiver. And so we're very thankful today to have the opportunity to share some of those components with you. To my left is Sam Kramer. Sam is our federal program analyst, specialist, and he's going to be reviewing with you the different components and elements within that waiver. And again, thank you so much for inviting us here today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Sam Kramer. As Deputy Commissioner Montano said, I am a federal education policy specialist at the Department of Education, and I have been involved in the creation of the request for the No Child Left Behind waiver that we're talking about today. First, before we get into the accountability system, I think it's good to set a little context as to what this process entailed. Back in September, the President and the Secretary of Education announced the opportunity for states to apply for a waiver to certain aspects of No Child Left Behind. These aspects were primarily related to the accountability area in No Child Left Behind, related to adequate early progress measurements and the sanctions attached to those. In order to get those waivers, the President and the Secretary set up a process in which states had to satisfy four principles. The first principle was to have college and career-ready academic standards. The second principle was to have an accountability system that gives recognition, support, and accountability to all schools. The third principle is to have effective teachers and leadership. That was really about principal and teacher evaluation systems primarily. And then the fourth principle was to reduce administrative burden on school districts. So upon the announcement of the waiver opportunity, the governor instructed the department to proceed with our application using the tools that we already had in our toolbox through years of development with our academic standards, through our assessment regime, through the new principal and teacher evaluation system that was passed in the last special session, and with the process we'd already begun with trying to find ways to streamline administrative burdens and paperwork for districts. The first, third, and fourth principles were not difficult for us to meet. Academic standards-wise, we are one of the leaders in the nation in terms of rigorous standards. In statute, we have already stated that standards must be aligned to college and career-ready expectations. So we're in some ways ahead of the game as far as other states go in that particular area. And principle one was really an opportunity for us to explain how we have implemented standards over the years, how we continue to implement standards moving toward the Common Core standards for English language arts, and what we've already done with our math standards, and also talking about professional development opportunities to get those standards out into the classroom. Principle 3, again, was really just describing the statutory changes that took place in the special session to create teacher and principal evaluation systems. We didn't have to change anything about what was proposed in the legislation there. We just needed to describe it and explain the processes that our task forces and work groups are going through right now to develop those systems. And then again, with reducing administrative burden, some of that comes through what we've proposed as an accountability system. But a lot of it was already taking place before the waiver opportunity came about as we looked to try to reduce some of the administrative burden on school districts. So what we were really left with was Principle 2, which was to create this new accountability system that recognizes, supports, and holds accountable all Title I schools in the state. This was an opportunity for us to take the best lessons that we had from No Child Left Behind and, again, use some of the tools that we already had in our toolbox through statute and use those in an accountability system that was more responsive to the needs of Minnesota. So what I'll do now is just go over briefly what it is that we're getting in this waiver and what we've proposed to get what we're getting. So first, I think it's important to keep in mind what stays the same. We still have the same academic standards. Nothing in the waiver changes that. Again, we're still holding our students to a rigorous college and career-ready standard for reading and math and science. The assessments that we use to measure proficiency and growth on those standards remain the same. We're using the MCAs. We're using the modified assessment, the MTAS assessment for alternative assessments for students in special education. Nothing about those assessments changes. The next thing that remains the same is public reporting. One of the things I think that most people would agree has been good about No Child Left Behind is that it's really put a lot of data in the hands of parents and community members so that they can evaluate the performance of the school in their neighborhood or their community and help to push some changes forward in that school. That all remains the same. And as we get further into the explanation here, I think you'll see that we have more public reporting under this new system that we've proposed. We'll continue to calculate adequate yearly progress, or AYP. I'll get into a little bit more detail on that in the next slide, but adequate yearly progress doesn't go away. The way we use it and the way that we determine it changes a little bit, but it doesn't go away, and that will still be reported every year. And then the disaggregation of data, I think, is something that is really critical to what we've proposed here and what has been in place for the last 10 years under No Child Left Behind. Previous to No Child Left Behind, prior to it passing in 2002, a lot of states and schools were able to hide behind your all students category. You know, our averages are really good. We look good across the board. But not identifying those subgroups of students, whether it was our students of color, our students in poverty, our English learners, our special education students who are not performing at so high of a rate. In Minnesota, what that has shown us over the last 10 years is that we have a gaping achievement gap, and that we have some groups of students that are performing very highly and others that are not performing very highly. The disaggregation of data is something that we think is really valuable in the current system and will be maintained in the system as we go forward. So what do we get in the waiver? As I said, we have new AYP targets. That's how we're going to change the way we calculate AYP. For those of you not familiar with the current system, AYP targets are based off of a 2014 statutory goal of 100% proficiency in all schools. That's a goal that in education circles and research really has been, frankly, delegitimized over time. Certainly a noble goal. We would like all of our students to be proficient, and nothing in the change reflects any change in that ideal. However, as the targets got closer to 100% and more schools failed to make AYP, we were getting closer to a situation where not making AYP didn't carry the same weight that it used to. The question was often raised by districts, what happens in 2014 when every school doesn't make AYP and every district doesn't make AYP? What does that really tell parents and community members about their school? So what we've done now is we've had an opportunity to reset those targets around a goal that's specific to Minnesota's greatest need. I refer to the achievement gap on the last slide, and in our new AYP targets, we use the achievement gap as the basis for our new goal, and that is to cut the achievement gap in half within a six-year period. And the way that we do that is our AYP targets are recalibrated so that every subgroup now has its own AYP target. And when you open up the paper and you look at the AYP targets this summer, what you'll see is that there are some subgroups that have significantly lower targets. Those targets are set by the current statewide averages of students around the state. And what we've been trying to explain to folks as we've been out on the road and talking about the waiver is that that is not the prescription for the problem. We don't think that the way to close the achievement gap is to set lower standards for certain groups of students. The prescription is that what we're what you're going to see when you see those lower targets, that's the diagnosis of the problem. We're going to have some groups of students in Minnesota that are performing very highly. We have others that aren't performing as well. That's the reality we live with right now. And what we're trying to do to address that reality is that those groups that are farther behind right now, whose targets will be lower in the next year or two, their targets go up at a faster rate than the targets of the students whose targets are higher up. So, for example, if 80% of white students are proficient, and that's their AYP index target right now, over the course of 6 years, they will be expected to cut non-proficiency in half, going from 80 to 90. Similarly, if you have a group of students, for example, American Indian students, who are at 50% right now, over the course of 6 years, we expect them to go from 50 to 75, cutting non-proficiency in half. And also, if you do the math on that, you've gone from an 80-50 30-point spread to a 90-75 15-point spread. Now, we haven't done a whole lot to move move the needle on this achievement gap in the last 10 years, so this is going to be an ambitious goal. To get students to a point where that gap has been closed in half is going to require a great deal of work. And more effective ways of trying to attack the achievement gap within schools. And we'll get to how we think this system will get after that in as we get into some of the multiple measurements and what we're doing in those schools that are identified in the new system. Another thing that we do get in the waiver is the elimination of sanctions for not making AYP. Right now, if you don't make AYP for a certain number of years and you're a Title I school, you are required to set aside certain federal funds for school choice and for supplemental educational services. These are two programs that, while well-intentioned, have not had any data-supported improvements shown over the course of the 10 years. Especially supplemental educational services has proven in some cases to really be a use of funding that has not proven to move achievement very much. However, there are some areas where that has been successful, and we would certainly encourage districts with this new freedom to use that 20% set aside as they choose to continue that type of programming if they so choose. But that would be a local decision. Again, we eliminate the financial set-asides for AYP, giving greater financial flexibility to districts to use their federal funding for school improvement activities that they have developed at the local level to address the needs of their particular students' groups and particular needs. There are other areas where there's greater flexibility with federal funds. Currently, there's a 50% limit on transferability of federal funds between certain pots of federal money that all school districts that receive federal aid get. That 50% limit goes up to 100% under the waiver. So there's a little bit more wiggle room for the way that districts can move money around to address, again, their specific needs for their students in their situation. And then finally, flexibility in school improvement planning. And I alluded to this a moment ago, but the system where you say you have to do school choice, you have to do supplemental educational services, or further down the line, you have to take this particular action for corrective action or restructuring, in some cases that is effective. Those have been effective actions. In other cases, not so much. What we're going to have the opportunity to do under this system is to be responsive to local needs and develop those ideas for what makes the most sense for schools at a local level based off of the specific needs of the school in question. So what is the new accountability system that we've proposed in Principle 2 in the waiver request to get all of this? And the thing that I want to really emphasize is that we are focused on two real goals here, and that's closing the achievement gap and promoting high growth for all students. And the way we do that is we built a system around multiple measurements. AYP is really built around a proficiency measurement. Schools make or don't make AYP primarily based off of their proficiency. That is not proven to be necessarily the strongest or most robust measure of school effectiveness in the last 10 years. So we're looking at multiple measurements now to look at schools and identify those that, again, are in need of recognition, support, and accountability. This new system creates incentives for high performance. The system we currently operate under is really one of mostly sticks, lacks a carrot. We have the opportunity with reward schools, and I'll go into some more detail about that later on with reward schools, though, to identify those schools that are performing highly. And we know that they're out there because we have such high scores on the NAEP tests and the ACT and so on. So we know that we have great schools in Minnesota, and we are now able to create incentives for high performance, try to push those schools in the middle to be those high-performing schools in the reward school category. The system addresses the achievement gap directly for the first time. AYP, again, with this aggregated data, did show where there was a low level of proficiency among students, but we didn't have a dedicated achievement gap measurement in the previous system. We do in the system that we have proposed here. Again, I'll go into more detail about that in the next few slides here. But this is an area where we haven't really taken this on head on. We've been very good at admiring the problem, as the commissioner has said many times while we've been out on the road, and this is an opportunity for us to really take some concrete action to address it. That comes through, again, measuring it for the first time, having a dedicated achievement gap measurement, but also in our identification of focus schools, a group of schools that are identified for their achievement gap specifically. And then finally, it gives us the opportunity to provide support for locally developed school improvement plans. A statistic that most people find alarming is that in the Department of Education, last year we got about 500 school and district improvement plans sent to us because of schools and districts that didn't make AYP. We have two people at the Department of Education who are reading those plans. 500 plans to totally redo the way that schools are operating, and two people to review them. As you can imagine, we just simply don't have the capacity to really help those schools make big improvements. Now, with this, we can work with a concentrated group of schools, the lowest performing schools in the state, and really develop a locally developed school improvement plan that is more responsive to the specific needs of the schools in question. So at the heart of this is our multiple measurements rating. So right now, all schools get AYP every year. We're moving towards a system where we'll, again, as I said earlier, we will continue to report AYP, but we'll also be reporting an MMR, the multiple measurements rating. We do know that that coincides with the mumps, measles, rubella acronym, and perhaps that's something we could revisit in the future. But for now, we're going to stick with MMR. The MMR is going to look at four measurements. It's going to look at proficiency because that is still an essential part of any accountability system. Or it's going to look at student growth. That is something that as we've gone around the state over the last several years and as you look at the research and education accountability systems, growth is really the direction that folks are moving. It's a good way of seeing how has a school affected a student's performance over the course of a year. So we're going to be looking at student growth. We're going to be looking at achievement gap closure again for the first time with a dedicated measurement on how well schools are doing at closing that achievement gap. And then we're also going to be looking at graduation rates because, as has been the case for many years in Minnesota, we know that it is necessary for students to have a high school diploma for them to enter into this economy that we have in the 21st century. So the first measurement is proficiency. And the proficiency measurement really builds off of what we've had with AYP for the last 10 years. Using the new AYP targets that we talked about a while ago here, we're going to look at the AYP index model and say what percentage of every school's subgroups made their AYP target. So this is, again, really an emphasis on subgroup performance and really making sure that we're shining a light on that achievement gap and making sure that schools can't hide behind doing well in most subgroups. We want to look at those schools that have struggled to have certain subgroups make their AYP targets. The weighting is based on the size. This is a weighted percentage. The weighting is based on the size of the subgroups, but it's weighted as such that smaller groups are given greater weight than they would be given if you did a straight percentage of weighting. So that a small group, for example, a group of 21 or 22 English learner students would carry greater weight in a school of 100 students than it would if you were just doing 21% of the value on that one group, if that makes sense. Unlike in the AYP calculation, many of you are probably familiar with the fact that there are 9 or 10 different ways to make AYP. You can make it through Safe Harbor, which is improvement year to year. For the purposes of the MMR, we're just looking at schools meeting their proficiency target. We're not making any exceptions for schools that have shown progress or shown growth. You've got to hit your target, and those targets, again, are set by that achievement gap closure goal that we've set for 6 years. So that's the first measurement we're looking at is proficiency. The second measurement, again, is growth. And growth really builds off of what we have in statute with the Minnesota growth model. Growth looks at the ability of schools to get students to exceed their predicted growth. And you might be sitting there thinking, okay, what does predicted growth mean? And that's a very good question. Predicted growth is based off of how students have performed previously on the assessments. So, for example, we look at all the third graders from the last two cohorts of students who are at a certain score point. We'll say 42, for example. So we look at every student who in third grade had a 42 on the MCAs. Then we look at how they did in fourth grade, and we average out their fourth grade score. So if they're at 40, if the average score in fourth grade for students who scored 42 was 45, and Johnny is a 42 in third grade, but he scores a 52 in fourth grade, so he's 7 points above the expected score that he'll have, then he'll have a positive growth score based off of his performance. We take all of those growth scores for every student in the school, and we average them, and that gives you your growth score. This is essentially the same way that we measure growth in the Minnesota growth model, using that, looking at two cohorts of students to set an average and an expectation for growth from year to year. And it uses the same methodology to do so. But we are looking at that average growth score for the whole school, and that's what we're going to be looking at. Then that's given a percentile ranking based off its relation to the rest of growth scores in the state. And that's how schools generate points in the growth domain on the multiple measurements rating. So that's our growth measurement. Using that same concept, we move into achievement gap reduction. An achievement gap reduction really is built around kind of a metaphor, if you will. We know that right now we have students who are doing really well, and we have students in certain subgroups that aren't doing very well. So essentially what we have is we have a race that's about to be run. And we have some students who are at the starting line. There are affluent students and our white students. Right now, their percentages of proficiency are very high. They're scoring very well. They're graduating at a high rate. But we have other subgroups of students that are not performing as well. So they're not at the starting line. They're 50 yards behind. So the theory of action in our achievement gap reduction measurement is that if this group of students who's farther behind is ever going to catch up to this group of students that's starting out ahead by the end of the race, they're going to have to run faster. So we're measuring the ability of schools to have students in those subgroups that are farther behind grow at a rate that is higher than the statewide average for the subgroups that are farther ahead right now. And if you project that out over time, if we're showing positive, if we're doing well on that, and we're actually in those subgroups around the state are exceeding the growth of the students who are ahead, who continue to grow, then we know that over time the achievement gap starts to close. And hopefully that feeds into more and more schools being able to meet their AYP targets, closing that gap in half within 6 years. So what we do on this is we look at the growth scores for the subgroups, the seven subgroups mentioned here. So we have our students of color, which would be our African-American students, our Hispanic students, our Asian-American students, and our American Indian students. We would also be looking at our English learners, our special ed students, and our free and reduced price lunch qualifiers, so our students in poverty. Those are the seven subgroups that we're looking at for this measurement. We look at their individual growth, each of those seven subgroups. We look at their subgroup average growth in the school and comparing it to the statewide average of their counterparts. So for students of color, we're looking at the growth of white students. For English learners, we're looking at non-English learners. For free and reduced price lunch qualifiers, we're looking for students who do not qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And for special ed students, we're looking at all non-special ed students. Again, if you're showing a negative score here, which means that your growth is higher than the statewide average in those subgroups, then you've had success in starting to close that achievement gap. One thing to note here is that schools are not given credit by having their higher performing group perform poorly. If you have bad growth in your white students or your affluent students, that does not translate to success on this measurement. It's based off statewide averages that are locked in based off of positive growth scores that we have for those students currently. Finally, we look at the graduation rate, and we use the same methodology as our proficiency domain in this graduation rate domain. So we're looking at the percentage of subgroups who made their AYP target and graduation rate. And this is a bit of a departure from what we do in AYP because there is not a lot of subgroup accountability on graduation rate in AYP. They look at subgroup graduation rates really only if you're trying to determine which schools qualify for safe harbor. So it's about the fifth or sixth step down the line to trying to make AYP that this comes into play. However, here in our MMR, we're taking a step toward greater subgroup accountability and graduation rate. And if you've looked at the statistics on graduation rates around the state of Minnesota, you can see why that's important. Certain subgroups of students in Minnesota just are not graduating at a very high rate. And having an accountability system that holds subgroups accountable to hard graduation rate targets really brings that kind of accountability to a system where it doesn't exist right now. Currently, the AYP graduation rate targets are 85%. Those are the targets we'll be using this first run of the MMR that we do in the spring after we get approved. But going forward, the AYP graduation rate and the AYP graduation rate targets will change. That happens regardless of the waiver. Starting next year, we have to look at four-year cohort rates. So we look at the percentage of students that are able to graduate within 4 years of their first day of being enrolled in ninth grade, essentially. So it's a bit of a change, and the targets will change accordingly. That's something that takes place whether we get the waiver or don't get the waiver. That's something that's in federal regulation and that we're moving toward either way. One thing to note on this graduation rate is that in AYP you can get credit for, again, year-to-year improvements. So maybe you improve your graduation rate by 2%, but you still only had a 60% graduation rate. In the MMR, we do not give credit for that. You only get credit by hitting your target of 85%. So you take all those four measurements. Obviously, in some cases, if you're talking elementary and middle schools, you're going to be looking at three measurements because you don't have a graduation rate measurement. But each domain will be worth 25 points. So for most elementary and middle schools, you're going to have 75 points possible. And for most high schools, you're going to have 100 points possible. And the MMR is then generated by dividing the total number of points earned by the total number of points possible. So you get a 0 to 100 percentage, and that's your MMR. So that's something that we'll be running for every school in the state, regardless of Title I status, the same way we run AYP for every school in the state, regardless of Title I status. Every school will have an MMR reported out. We plan on putting that on the school report card on our website so that parents can get in and see how their schools are performing on each of the four measurements and then can go in and compare to other schools, other districts, or even the statewide averages. We feel like this is, again, giving parents and community members more information than they've ever had before to assess the performance of the school. We feel like that's really going to enable them to push reforms in the school that move us towards a better education system for all students. You're probably wondering then, what is it that you do with that MMR in the Title I schools? And that's really where the rubber meets the road for these Title I schools. Currently, under the AYP system, you move into a status of AYP based off of the number of years you have or have not made AYP. After you haven't made it for 2 years, you're in stage one. Every year after that you don't make it, you proceed in the stages. Under the waiver, those stages go away, and we replace them with these three groups. At the top, we have our 15% of Title I schools, roughly 125 schools, that will be categorized as reward schools. Again, this is a real departure from what we do with AYP, where we are acknowledging not just those schools that aren't doing so well, but acknowledging those schools that are performing at a high level. Reward schools will, again, be about 125 schools around the state, and they will be representative. All three of these categories are representative proportional to the size of each type of group. So proportional to how many Title I high schools there are in the state, how many Title I elementary schools, and how many Title I middle and junior high schools in the state.
Could you just elaborate? What's your basis for deciding that you know already that 125 are reward schools?
That's based off of historical numbers of Title I schools in the state. Last year, I think there were 842 Title I schools in the state. Mm-hmm. Since we've set the number of reward schools at the top 15%, so any school that finishes in that top 15% is a reward school, that would go out to roughly 126 schools. So we're looking at year to year. There isn't a huge change year to year in the number of Title I schools, so we're using historical data to determine the number of reward schools that we're projecting.
So that 15% isn't magic. There could be more in it. You have a bar
that's right, with
the MMR that will mean that they get to that point.
That's right. It's just that top 15%. You line the schools up top to bottom in each of the categories. So elementary schools are lined up the highest MMR to the lowest MMR, and we just chop off the top 15% in their reward schools. If the number of elementary schools that are Title I increases or decreases, then the number of reward schools would increase or decrease accordingly.
So then it isn't a proficiency model. It's a hard percentage.
That's right. Yeah, I apologize if there was any confusion, Madam Chair. It's a percentage. We're looking at the top 15%. And then bottom five, and then another 10% of schools. So it's not a magical statistical number. If you have a proficiency rate of this or a growth rate of this, or it's not a hard number that they're reaching to get into these categories. It's we're identifying a certain number of schools based off of their performance.
So what if some quite a number catch the fire and are high flyers in this? I mean, you wouldn't acknowledge that? You're just going to be like the old bell curve?
Madam Chair, members, well, certainly we hope that that's the case, that that we have increasingly high performance. I think the theory of action behind having a limited number of reward schools was that we want to really identify the best of the best. We want it to be a meaningful reward when they are recognized for being reward schools. And if you start just expanding that to be any school that reaches, you know, this bar, you run the risk, I suppose, of undervaluing or diminishing the importance of that recognition.
Well, I'm not sure I accept that, but proceed anyway.
So. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, so that's the top 15%. At the bottom, then, we have the bottom 5% of priority schools. So bottom 5% of Title I schools is roughly 40 to 45 schools. Those will be identified as priority schools. Again, we're just talking about Title I schools here. 19 of those schools will be automatically identified based off of their school improvement grant status. We have 19 schools right now that are SIG schools. They're automatically identified because they have been previously identified through the SIG program as persistently low performing. So we'll have an additional 21 to 26 schools roughly that are identified as the lowest performing on the MMR that will join that group as priority schools. Then we do something that's completely different from what we do now, and that's identify this focus school group, which is based strictly off of achievement gap. The focus schools group is 10% of Title I schools, so about 80 to 85 schools. The focus schools are the list of focus schools is generated by looking at schools, the bottom 10% of schools based on their proficiency in those seven subgroups that I mentioned, and also their growth in those seven subgroups that I mentioned. So it's a combined 50-50 score on those two to generate the focus school list. So we'll have schools on that list that have both low rates of proficiency among students of color, students in poverty, English learners, and special education students, but also are not getting any growth out of those students to start to close that achievement gap. With reward schools, the primary reward is recognition. We are looking at the possibility of repurposing federal funds or seeking private donors to try to create some type of financial incentive, primarily for them to share best practices with some of our lower performing schools. But that's something that we're pursuing. We don't have that in place right now. So the primary reward for reward schools is public recognition. Priority schools are expected to use a model of school turnaround that's similar to the SIG model. That can send shivers up people's spine because I know there are a lot of opinions about the SIG school models because there are four of them and they're very strict about you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this. The guidance from the waiver is that those schools have some flexibility in the way that they implement school turnaround. There is an expectation that those schools will drastically change the way that they do business. If you look in the request that we've submitted, we outline a number of different interventions and techniques that would be used based off our experience of working with SIG schools. So those priority schools, you'll see things like implementation of professional learning communities, data-driven decision-making, the use of value-added research models to identify areas of need, really revamping the way that the school does business. And that's what we're going to be seeing in those priority schools. We'll be using our statewide system of support out in the regions to support those schools and their efforts, and also the expertise within the Department of Education to provide support to those schools. Focus schools are identified, again, based off of an achievement gap issue. So the first thing that they do is they really have to figure out what are our subgroups that are not performing well. In some cases, it will be three or four subgroups. In some cases, it will just be one. We'll help them with a data analysis to identify their areas of need, and then they'll be required to create a school improvement plan. and they will work on that school improvement plan with their district and with the technical support of the statewide system of support and the Department of Education. It's important to note that the focus and priority schools, once identified in the spring, are on the list for 3 years. The list does not change in those 3 years unless they meet certain exit criteria. The exit criteria for both is that they exit the bottom 25% of schools for two consecutive years. We've looked at our impact data, which has shown that that type of improvement from a school would be reflective of a major change in the school's performance and would be a real change in trajectory for that school. If a school were to exit focus or priority status, we have outlined a process in which we would continue to monitor and work with that school on an improvement plan, but they would not carry that focus or priority label, and we wouldn't be as intimately involved in the day-to-day operations of the schools. So those are the three groups of schools we'll be working with. The question that's often come up is what happens to those other 70% of schools? And I would first point out that in the current system, and in this system too, we're just talking about Title I schools. There's 842 out of 2,000-some schools around the state. So a large percentage of schools in the current system and in this system are left somewhat outside of this. They continue to have AYP reported. All schools are going to have MMR reported for them. So that will be in place, and we do believe that by providing more data, we're giving parents, community members more to work with in terms of identifying needs within schools. And that's really going to be essential, that kind of parent to community engagement is going to be essential to working within those schools that don't fall in the priority or focus category or the rewards category to continue to improve. There are two additional categories of schools that we have added on our own. This was not part of the federal guidance or requirements, but we took the task of trying to capture some of those other schools in the 70% quite seriously based off of conversations with our stakeholders group. The first group is our celebration schools. Now, the celebration schools is the group of schools that the 25% that fall right underneath the reward schools. So you're going to get anything in the top 40% that's not in the top 15%, essentially. Those schools will have an opportunity to apply, send an application to the Department of Education outlining reasons that perhaps go beyond assessment data. So looking at rigorous course taking, college placement statistics, school environment. It could be any number of qualitative measures that they use, or they could focus strictly on assessment and performance data if they chose to do so. Within that group, we'll identify an additional 10% of Title I schools as celebration schools. Then at the bottom, we'll identify the bottom 25% annually as continuous improvement schools. Now, some of those will be priority and focus schools, so they'll already be working on school improvement plans, trying to move the ball forward in terms of achievement. However, there will be a lot of schools that fall into this group that won't be priority or focus schools, and they will be required to write a school improvement plan and work with their district to really determine what's the best course of action for them moving forward. We will not be requiring districts to submit those improvement plans to the department. As I said, that's a capacity issue in many ways for us. If we're going to be focusing on the 5% and the 10% at the priority and focus schools, we're not able to give meaningful feedback on 500 applications or 500 school improvement plans the way we do now. However, we will audit 10% of the continuous improvement schools every year to ensure that there is fidelity with this planning and improvement activity. So we do believe that that will ensure that schools that fall into this continuous improvement area of schools will continue to work to improve the school. So I'll just wrap up real quickly then by showing kind of a graphical representation of what we're talking about here with the groups that I've described. At the top, we have our top 15% of Title I schools. They're reward schools. At the bottom, we have the second group, priority schools. They're our bottom 5% of schools. Then we have our focus schools, which are somewhere in the middle, generally going to be a lower performing school in general, but definitely lower performing when it comes to achievement gap issues. That's 10%. Our continuous improvement group is the bottom 25% of schools. And then we have our celebration schools that fall underneath the reward schools and in the end represent 10%. So you have 25% at the top, 25% at the bottom. And then possibly additional schools from focus that fall somewhere between. So those are the categories of schools that we're going to be working with. Those are the measurements that we'll be using to identify them. We process-wise, I think everyone here is aware, we submitted our application on November 14th. We received a letter from the Department of Education on December 20th outlining some concerns and areas where they'd like us to provide a stronger rationale or give more information or perhaps look at changes. We have since resubmitted our application. That was on January 13th. I believe a copy of that has been provided to all members of the committee. If not, we'd be happy to provide you with one. We've had conversations since January 13th with the Department of Education on a nearly daily basis, going back and forth on some further changes and clarifications, and we await word from them as to when and if we will be approved. The process is such that if we are not immediately approved for the waiver, they continue to work with us until we are approved. This isn't like Race to the Top where some states get it and some states don't. Their stated goal at the beginning of this process was that all states would get to a yes. 11 states applied on November 14th, and our understanding is that their goal is still to have all 11 states get to a yes. When that happens is very much dependent on our ability to meet all of their requirements. So we're just waiting to see when an announcement would come and if we're part of that initial group that is approved.
Great. Well, it's been very fluent and thorough presentation, but there probably are some questions that have been aroused by it. Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate that you open another opportunity to review this because this is quite a complex issue, and I need multiple presentations. I can't tell you how much I appreciate how much work you have put into this. You have brilliant staff that are so prepared to present and something that is so complex. So, but I still need more time to digest all of this. But before I go into some questions that are kind of more technical about this, Madam Chair, at the beginning of our hearing, you stated we will take action.
We won't be taking any action today on anything.
Do we need to? I have kind of some questions about the technical connection here with us. Do we need to take action on this?
I think our purpose here is reviewing. We want to be sure that what's being done with this is kind of an executive branch to the federal government. The legislature does have a role. We've obviously set standards and have been pretty active in that, probably more than some states have. And I think one of the challenges that we've had in Minnesota is that we didn't game the system of No Child Left Behind. We've set real, standards. Some have tried to get low enough so that they'd look better. And that has not been our practice here. And we just want to be sure that when you go for waivers and do things differently, that it isn't we aren't deserting some of the objectives that we've had of young people reaching proficiency. So I think that's why it's important for us to understand this and determine, be comfortable that that our statutory actions and are not being ignored, but I think we've all heard and are all aware that while there's some aspects of this law that have revealed to us, such as the disaggregation of data, that we aren't as good as we would like to think we are in some of these areas, and that's a motivation to continue to work for improvement. But by the same token, we don't. We want to be sure that we aren't handling it in such a way that you have a discouragement of people to proceed. And I think you stated it very well, of all of these schools, pretty soon it kind of becomes meaningless because people, if every school was failing and a lot of parents know that their kids are doing very well, and, I mean, it doesn't quite do the job of communicating and continuing to motivate to get where we really want to go. So,
Madam Chair, let me then just reframe the question. Is your intention to have legislative action taken in this committee to attach to this waiver process in some manner? I'm just kind of unclear.
I don't know that we've even talked about that kind of thing. I think we've been trying to maintain the communication with the department and see that it is not inconsistent. And we think that the legislature, as engaged in setting policy, ought to be informed, and we ought to have continued good communication. But I'm not. It's not evident to me that we need some legislative change at this point.
Or action?
Okay. Or action.
I see. I was just unclear as to what is our responsibility. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're
just
welcome.
Just wanted to kind I of think, have that clear as to what is our next sure. step with respect to what the committee is going to do.
Deputy Commissioner, I got a mental block right then. I was going to say, I mean, you're, was, would like to interject here. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator, I just wanted to say that while it is an executive branch initiative, the department and the executive branch very much values an open communication with the legislature and wants to make sure that that you understand where we're going with this and the rationale and the reasoning behind it, and very much want to keep you in the communication. And because of that, we've had numerous opportunities for engagement with the legislature and other stakeholders. So while it is an executive initiative, we very much want to keep those communications open and very much value your input and insights into this.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I may then, since I guess the action that we want is just to provide input and perhaps get some questions answered, I have a question about the direct connection between the process, how you measure growth, and how that connects to the actual achievement gap reduction portion of this process. Because it seems to me that if the process that you utilize, so this is to really measure growth in the schools and the individual student against a benchmark that it helps you with dealing with the achievement gap. In other words, the measure really puts you at a higher level, then the two of them are not connected. And I would like you to expand on that, because I feel that the way you presented growth and the way you measure growth does not help you achieve the goal of reducing the gap. Am I incorrect in that? Could you please explain how the growth measure ultimately connects with the elimination of the gap in simple terms?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray.
As simple as they can.
I'll do my best.
Senator Torres-Ray, that's a very good question. Well stated.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I think it depends on which gap you're talking about. Mm-hmm. If the gap is measured as the number of students who are proficient in one subject and the number of students who aren't proficient and the gap between them, then growth and the achievement gap measurement, which uses growth as its primary measurement, that is sort of a theory of action where if students are growing, especially those students who are farther behind and subgroups that are farther behind, if they are growing at a rate that is faster than the rate of students who are currently more likely to be proficient because of their subgroup, then over time, the gap begins to close. Now, I think the question you're asking is the gap reduction measurement or the growth measurement explicitly tied to an expectation of if you grow at this rate for a certain number of years, that student will then become proficient? Is that the direction that your question was going in?
Correct. So the growth measure that you talk about is a gap within a gap,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there is a gap here and you're making progress. Well, that's progress and that's growth.
Mm-hmm.
Are we dealing with achievement gap? No. So I want you to dissect that for me, because unless we understand that, then we're making no progress in terms of eliminating the gap that exists between groups, between schools, between kids. So is that separated? Are we measuring the growth in a way that helps us achieve a result that narrows the gap between in general? I hope I'm making that.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, over time, if you had a good score on the achievement gap measurement within your school, you would, in theory, close the achievement gap. You would, if you have higher rate of growth than those students who are performing poorly right now, mm-hmm. and they grow at a higher rate for a number of years, then yes, you're going to see the results of that. It is not explicitly tied to a growth to standard or growth to proficiency measurement. That's something that some other states have chosen to do. It's some that other states have chosen not to do. And there's been some debate in the education research community on psychometricians and whatnot as to which is the preferable way to do it. This was a model we chose based off of what we thought was best given the information we had. I'm not an expert on those particular statistical models that growth the standard and whatnot, so I would not be the best person to talk about that. If you had more questions about that, we do have some folks here from our assessment division who could probably go into greater detail on that if that's something you're interested in.
Thank you.
I think we may need that because for an understanding, if you aren't getting to the standard of proficiency, you know, you can keep growing forever and never ever get there. And I think that's not what the ultimate goal is. We need to get proficiency, and obviously there has to be more than what's average achievement in each given year in order for the gap to start closing.
Yeah, Madam Chair, to the growth domain specifically, one of the reasons, and my colleague Chris here can go into greater detail on this, but just to give kind of a high-level explanation for why one was chosen over the other, the growth to standard, growth to proficiency really ends up measuring a fairly narrow group of students who are close to the achievement line, that proficiency cut score on one side or the other. It ends up setting a very low standard for growth for students who are above the proficiency line, because all that's expected of them is to grow high enough that they can stay proficient. And where students are well above the achievement line in third grade or fourth grade, it's not very difficult for them to grow at a level that they stay at proficiency. Similarly, at the bottom end, students who, for example, in sixth grade read at a second grade level, the task of getting them growth to proficiency in a measurable way, a statistically measurable way, is unlikely. I think the growth levels in that, and I will let Chris explain kind of the frequency of that, but it doesn't happen very often. That said, you can go from second grade to fourth grade, and if we're measuring success of school, I think even though that doesn't necessarily equate to growth to proficiency in a set time period necessarily, if a sixth grader goes from second grade reading to fourth grade reading, the thought of using the growth model that we used was that that's something that should be acknowledged and rewarded, because two levels of growth in a year would be outstanding growth. So I'll defer to Chris on some of the more technical questions and a little bit more research-based reasoning for why we chose to go the way we will.
Thank you. Chris, introduce yourself and give your full name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Chris Moore. I'm a quantitative analyst in the Assessment and Testing Division at the Minnesota Department.
Is that Moore?
Moore, M-O-O-R-E.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And I bring an educational sciences perspective to this. I'm an educational psychologist by training. I'd also like to make a personal note that I'm a first-generation college graduate, so I believe strongly in public education and its ability to impact people's lives. And I am very passionate about closing the achievement gap. And with that in mind, looking at the growth model as a foundation that we already have in place, what that specifies in the growth model in statute is the use of standard deviation measures. And in the educational sciences, we use standard deviations all the time to talk about standardized effect sizes. And so essentially what we're doing is what we're ranking schools on are standardized effect sizes. Oftentimes a standard deviation effect size of 0.2 is considered small, 0.5 medium, and 0.8 large. So what we essentially do for the growth gap measure that you asked about is we take statewide and we look at what is that average standard deviation growth for historically advantaged groups. And this is where the idea of focusing on growth gaps as opposed to a cross-sectional single-year achievement gap measure came from, is that if we already have advantaged students who are already at the starting gates out in front, and also their rates of growth, according to the growth measure that we have been using for several years now, if those advantage groups have both are starting out ahead and growing at a faster rate, this is empirical evidence, then what do we have to do? We have to hold schools accountable to encouraging accelerated growth among disadvantaged groups. And so what we do is we just do a simple subtraction, and that's what comes up with the growth gap measure that particular domain is based on. So we just take the statewide. If, for example, at the statewide level, the advantage group is growing at a rate of 0.5 standard deviation above expectation, but the disadvantaged group in a school is growing at one standard deviation, that would be outstanding, and that would result in a negative value. That means a reduction in the growth gap measure, and that school would be among the highest ranking in that particular domain.
And Mr. Moore, that's what we have been doing the past 3 years, but the needle hasn't moved? Or is this being changed for this? Was this changed for this application?
Yes, we basically applied, a mathematical enhancement to the way we have traditionally done the growth model to highlight and hold schools accountable to actively. There's a theory of action that to closing the achievement gap.
Madam Chair, I think one thing that should be pointed out is that while the growth model has existed for, I think, as you said, 3 years, the achievement gap measurement specifically is a new use of the growth model to measure the achievement gap specifically, and that is something that we have just developed for this application. I think it's also important to note that the statutory growth model is the foundation for what we're using here, for what we use here. We use the same way of measuring year-to-year growth of students. There are a few minor differences between the way that we use it. We incorporate students who have taken alternative assessments, so students who are in special education. That was a requirement of the waiver that you include all students in all measurements. And then we also have used baseline years from the last 2 years, so it's more recent data than the baseline data that was used to develop the growth expectations in the statutory growth model. But
could you put together either a diagram or some illustrations to help some of those of us who are visual learners that you could share with the committee?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
If you could do that, and I know you understand some of those things, but I think we need to, and I'm not meaning to interrupt. I did interrupt you, Senator Torres-Ray, but I'm coming back to you on it. I think there's probably more of us that need to be able to picture and see how that really works.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide that to you and staff.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray, I'll let you continue, and then Senator Hand, I think, is waiting for questions as well.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Chris, Mr. Moore, you took me back to school. The description of the statistical deviation model that you describe is very good, and I understand it, and I have plenty of confidence that with your skills, you're going to put this in place and we're going to have good results. I've plenty of confidence in that. My question is not really related to the actual model that measures the growth so that you kind of keep track of that growth. And clearly what you stated makes a lot of sense. If there is growth at the end of the day, you kind of, deal with that gap that exists numerically. That will result. My question is more related to the actual benchmark that you establish to get to that place, right? So how you measure to get there, I have confidence that you have the mathematical method in place. The reason that I'm skeptical about the benchmark is if you use a standard versus proficiency, which other states have used, the growth doesn't get us as far as we need to go, right? So there is growth, absolutely. Statistically, you would think that you get to a place where you close that because you're providing the growth that helps you close that gap. Yet, at the end, the measurement that you use to get there mathematically is really not a proficient model. It's not a good result, in other words. It's not a high mathematical number. That's my question. Do we have a high mathematical number that tells me that when you measure it, use all of the statistical deviation that you're going to put in place, I get to a number that is a high number of proficiency, and then I know that not only I narrow the gap, but I put a kid. So in other words, I got a kid to be a little bit better than he was, and I kind of narrow the gap, but it was not mathematically significant to say that we have a better result in place, that we're graduating. That's where I think, when I said that we're not really, in essence, closing the achievement gap in Minnesota because our gap is so big because the measurement of proficiency is low. Am I making sense with this? So it's not the method you use to measure it, is the end result, what I'm more concerned about.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Rae.
Mr. Kramer.
You raise a very good question, and where what you're talking about really comes into play the most is in that proficiency domain.
Correct.
In the proficiency domain, what we're measuring is your ability to have your students in all subgroups make progress year to year on proficiency.
Right.
The growth measurement is really separate from that. Now, we use all of this because we think it all balances itself out well. It's the type of model that a lot of other states have used, looking at multiple measurements and having them each complement each other. Within the growth domain, I know there has been some concern from folks that it is not tied to that growth standards, that you're rewarded for growth that doesn't necessarily lead to proficiency. What we have done to try to address that, and Chris can speak to this, is that between the initial application on November 14th and our resubmission on January 13th, all of our smart statistical math guys here went back into their offices and they did a study that essentially showed what rates of growth would be required for students at each score point year to year in order to get to proficiency. We have that data, and we will be publishing that data. We believe that by communicating that expectation along with the growth scores that we report, that you can really show here's where students need to be to get to proficiency. That sets an expectation. Now, that is not built into our scoring model for growth. There are several reasons for that, not least of which is that the growth required to get to proficiency is different for each student at each score point. So setting a line that says you have to be this high a growth or above in order to get points would leave some students, it wouldn't be high enough for them to get to proficient. For others, it would be, well, that's too high. They only need to be at this point in order to get to proficiency. So we're going to be publishing these individualized targets that you can use to say, okay, my student last year was a 41. I can see that he needs to grow at a point six standard deviation over the course of the next 3 or 4 years in order to get to proficiency. Or if your student is at a 53, you can say, I can see that my student needs to have at least a 0.1 growth score in order to stay proficient in the future. But that is not built into the actual scoring model. The proficiency aspect of it is captured in the proficiency domain.
And just a final comment.
Yes, okay,
I'm done, I promise, Madam Chair. I would very much like to have a meeting about this with some people. I think, you know, clearly Mr. Moore and I were involved in these conversations many years ago. That's one of the reasons I ran for office, so I had to consult with my professors. We have some very interesting people who have done extensive analysis of this. I believe that without this component, it will be difficult for us to really arrive to a point where we can truly measure the progress and actually indicate, you know, how the progress was made. And I think that this is a significant component of dealing with achievement gap. And so I just as a recommendation, I know this is complex and I can't believe you've made so much progress on this, but I as I said at the beginning of this, the connection between growth and achievement gap reduction as your main components of this presentation to me were not completely connected, and it's because of this. So I would like to encourage you to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank you for your presentation. I had a question kind of along the same topic of this growth measurement, and I think I understand what you're saying is that you've got two groups. One is not performing as well as another, and the one that's not performing as well would presumably have to grow at a faster rate than the higher performing group, and if that happens over some period of time, you get closer to, if not to, proficiency. But it's also possible that you could see growth by having the higher performing group grow at a slower rate than they would. And so instead of seeing growth on the upper end, you might see erosion at the growth on the lower end, erosion at the upper end, and you might still be able to, in aggregate, show progress. And my question is, in this model, are you going to be able to tell the difference?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand,
that's
an excellent question, and one that was raised quite vigorously, I think, in our stakeholders group. We have the scores that we have right now for the higher performing groups, those that have set the benchmark for where you are. We have made a policy decision within the application that those scores are set unless they improve, because we're using statewide data. So, for example, if our white students were to go down 2/10 of a point on their growth scores in the next few years. The subsequent target for the achievement gap measurement would not follow them down. It would remain high. However, if they were to improve, which is obviously what we all hope for, we want all of our students to have higher rates of growth, then it would go up in order to set a higher expectation for those students that are farther behind.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kramer, for your presentation. I agree with Senator Torres-Rae 100%. I think that you've done some phenomenal things here with measuring. I tend to be kind of a simple guy. And, you know, I think the easier something is to understand, the better. And as I look at this, one of the concerns I have is, are we losing track of the goals? We're so wrapped up in the measurement aspect and in the comparison. Are we losing track of that goal of getting these children educated? So I guess I was hoping you could take just a minute and talk to me about what are some of those hard line goals. I guess I share some of the same concerns that Senator Hahn has. Maybe I'm taking this a step further than what he is. You know, are we're going to be so concentrated on one segment of our student population, we're going to lose track of the other students at the top. I desperately don't want to see that slide occur. I really, really like some of the things that we've done recently, especially with Chairwoman Olson's literacy by third grade. I represent the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and that I feel is going to just be a perfect fit for that school district. As a matter of fact, you know, they are taking some of those very achievable goals that they have with that program. They're going to receive the reward, which in that case is a monetary reward, right? And you spoke about that a little bit, but you also commented that's almost a side thought. Well, as unfortunate or fortunate, depending on how you look at it, that might be. That is a very hard driving force behind what we do in education is funding, right? Because education takes resources, and that resource is monetary. So I bring you back to my school district. They are going to be able to take that resource now, and they're going to be able to invest that in things like early education to continue that growth. We've allowed them now the flexibility, the simplicity, right? That's going back to the I'm kind of a simple guy. I like to keep things simple. All we've done in that program is we've presented a monetary reward and a very measurable goal. And I feel like I think we've already seen benefits from it, and I'm excited to see what those future benefits are. So going back to my original question, could you tell me a little bit about what those hard goals are?
Certainly. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Kramer.
Kind of a two-part question, I think, and I'll answer the first one, which is what are the goals of this? And I think what we've tried to outline is that the two main goals that we have that we think need to be improvements on the current system are a focus on the achievement gap, as you alluded to, so looking at proficiency through the lens of improving at a faster rate for those students that are in groups that are farther behind, measuring achievement gap specifically for the first time, and then identifying focus schools to really get into the schools that are making the biggest contribution to the achievement gap so that we see statewide that bears out. So that would be the first goal. The second goal actually in some ways gets back to the line of questioning and discussion a moment ago with growth to standard, and that's that all students are incentivized to grow in the system. And what I mean by that is that right now, what we hear from school districts and teachers that are working with this testing stuff that we have to do is that there's a real incentive to focus on the so-called bubble kids. I don't know if this is a term you're all familiar with, but these are the students who are within a few points of proficient on either side. So you've got your students who are maybe a few points above proficient and are at some risk of falling behind. And you've got some students who are a few points behind proficient, but it's reasonable to say if we really push it, they might be able to get to proficient. We fear that if that kind of system stays in place, those students on each end of the spectrum, so the students who are high performing at the beginning of the year, those students who are low performing at the beginning of the year, don't have the incentive. There's no incentive to focus on students like that. So we're looking for high growth from all students. And that was another thing you alluded to, I think, is, you know, if you're focusing really just on achievement gap, what happens to those students who are performing really well? Our growth measurement, by not being growth to standard, allows us to say it's not just important that those kids right around that proficiency line grow. It's also important that those kids who are 65s on their MCAs, well above that proficiency line, it's important that they grow too. If those students aren't growing at a high rate, that's going to reflect poorly on a school's growth score. Similarly, those students who are way down at the bottom, if they grow at a high rate but maybe not quite to that proficiency line, we still think that, to use the example I used earlier, if your sixth grader goes from third grade to fifth grade, didn't get to proficient, but made extraordinary growth, two grade levels in a year, that's something that we want to incentivize as well. So we're hopeful that this is an opportunity to expand that bubble kid group, or maybe it's been five kids out of 30 in the current system. We want it to be all 30 kids should be bubble kids. You should be incentivized to have growth in all students. So that was the theory of action behind using growth the way we used it, and then with the achievement gap, using the achievement gap measurements and the proficiency measurement the way that we use it. As for the monetary incentives and rewards, we would certainly, if we had the finances for it, we would certainly look to that. We would look for opportunities for that. As I mentioned, we are looking at the possible repurposing of federal funding. Some of our SIG funds are in a place where, with this change now, there could be an opportunity to free those up for different uses. This could potentially be one of those uses. And if somebody were to present funding from the private sector to incentivize growth toward that reward school status, we would certainly welcome that opportunity. But we are working with limited resources, and that this is a reflection on that. And I'll
Commissioner Mantegna.
Madam Chair, Senator, if I could just add a little bit to what Mr. Kramer was commenting. We have been in communication with a number of schools in terms of, if we had a reward system, what would make a difference to them? And it's amazing how some of them say it's not even about the money. It's about being acknowledged for the hard work that they have done. So in many cases, they would be perfectly happy with the department doing some kind of acknowledgement with respect to these schools. But the other thing that we're hoping to do is begin to identify some of the things that are really working well in these schools and match some of those components up with some of the schools that are priority schools or even focus schools, but primarily priority schools. And those schools would have the funding that would enable them to pay for some of the staff from these reward schools to come and help them implement some of the strategies that they're using that are being very successful. Obviously, the matching would have to be closely aligned to the demographics of the schools and the needs of the schools. But that is something that we're looking at, and they looked at that very favorably and said, yes, obviously we can't take resources from our school right now to do that because we need staff here. But if there was a monetary, reward in terms of we pay for some of their staff to come help these other schools that we match them up with, they're very much in favor of that. And as I said, it's amazing how some of them said it's not even about getting money. It's about, can you acknowledge us for the hard work that we've done and the fact that we are an outstanding school? And I think that's something that is very easily done.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly we've had a lot of folks working on this, and I appreciate your hard work. There's a couple items I'm going to ask you to kind of address with me that I think maybe need some further clarification. First, it's exciting that we have an option to get a waiver from No Child Left Behind. We wish the feds would act, but they haven't, and so we will do that. As a prior special education teacher, I'm thrilled that we're talking about a growth model. Some of us have been talking about it for years, and it's nice to see it on a statewide level now. So that is a real improvement from No Child Left Behind. And there were good things in No Child Left Behind, but that was one of the problems, was not having that growth model. So I think that's a great thing. But I also kind of want to touch back on what Chair Olson said. I think we can't lose sight of the proficiency piece. And when I look at standard deviations, and I'm thinking about a mother, I don't really want to know what the standard deviation is as far as how my child grew compared to the rest of the kids in his or her class. What I would want to know is, what's the standard deviation for my child in reading? Is he or she reading on grade level or math? And so it seems to me that, you know, sometimes pendulums swing too far the other way. And I think we have to be very careful that we don't do that here. And I'd like to encourage us to think about a standard deviation for proficiency. I think we can't lose sight of that. And also, as much as we're having an interesting time trying to understand all this, think about all of the parents who might not have all of you to ask these questions to. And so I don't want to lose sight of the importance of proficiency as well. And then the second, and I'll tell you all of my thoughts, and then I'd like you to please expand on them. Then the second thought that I was running over in my mind had to do with flexibility of funds, and that's something that we seek so hard, and we are usually so happy to allow our school districts or any of our local units of government to have flexibility of funds. After all, they're the feet on the ground, and they know what's best, and each situation is different. And as a former Title I teacher, I can tell you that's fabulous, because I've seen how that lack of flexibility of funds has not necessarily served kids. But there's one piece that, if I'm reading the notes right on the application, that concerns me a little bit. And that has to do with flexibility to the point that low-income parents are no longer going to have access to federal funds for tutoring for their children. You know, quite frankly, they can't wait until the school turns around. If I had a child that was in a school and needed some tutoring, I would want to be able to access that tutoring right now. We would need to do that. So I would like you to address maybe that lack of flexibility that additional flexibility that now that actually may hurt low-income parents. So I think that's something we need to be concerned about. And the third thing I would just mention is incentives. I don't see any incentives here. You know, we've had some incentives for school districts to turn around, and now we don't necessarily see those incentives, and I think that's something that that should be addressed. And then just finally, the achievement gap. I think it was touched on with some of my colleagues' comments, but it's very important that when we talk about an achievement gap, we are not we're talking about a student, a gifted and talented student, who's not achieving at the level that they could. So I think we do a great disservice to our kids if we only say the achievement gap is for those who are not performing at grade level. So I'm hoping you can address some of those concerns for me.
Who wants to tackle what?
Madam Chair,
Kramer.
Senator Nelson, I can try to go down that list. As for proficiency and individual student proficiency, I think it's really important to differentiate between a school accountability system and expectations for students. The expectation for students has been and always will be that they're college and career ready when they graduate from high school. That's what we use our assessments to measure, but we also might use it to measure growth. The use of growth in this system, in this proposal, is really meant to be a measure of school performance. That we also look at proficiency for school performance too. We do think both of those have great value, and that's why they're both in the system. But what we've been told as this has progressed over time with No Child Left Behind, as you alluded to, is that there are the lack of a growth model really left us in a position where we weren't getting a full picture of what was going on in the school. So certainly proficiency remains the goal for students. Students still get their individualized reports on how their parents get their reports on how the student did. As I alluded to earlier, we have developed these new growth targets that can be set for students in terms of how does an individual student have to grow over time in order to get to proficient. We'll make that available for parents, and hopefully that's something that will, from a communication standpoint, set expectations for teachers, for parents, and for students. So that's the way we're trying to address that, and we're certainly sensitive to that concern. As for your reference to after-school tutoring,
yes,
and the supplemental educational services, there's been a considerable amount of work done, research done, on supplemental educational services provided under No Child Left Behind. And the consensus, it's not unanimous, but amongst many, has been that it has been mostly a waste of money. There are certainly examples, and we've all heard anecdotal reasons, times where it's been effective, and we should celebrate that. What we were told time and time again from districts while it was going on is that give us the opportunity to provide that after-school tutoring, as the system does not right now. It's about hiring private providers to come in. Let the district develop a tutoring program that is aligned to the standards and the curriculum in the school that has more collaboration with the teacher. That is something that is still completely within the realm of possibility if districts choose to do that. Districts may still choose to contract out with SES providers if that's something that they're in favor of. The waiver requirements did not require the continuation of that mandatory set aside for SES or school choice. To my knowledge, only one state of the 11 has maintained that. And I think that's a reflection that nationally folks have said, while it might work in some places, it doesn't work everywhere and it shouldn't be a requirement. I would also point out that in many rural areas, they're unable to contract out with quality providers. They've ended up with some online options that have frankly not been very effective in most cases. So this is an opportunity for, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul may choose to continue SES services. That would be their choice, and they may have access to better providers. Someone up north in a more rural, isolated area might not have access to high-quality SES and might choose not to provide it in the future.
If I might just add, sometimes we do all get hung up on the processes, whether it's tutoring, whether it's whatever. That was one of the things in working on the literacy. What's undergirding it? So when they're tutoring, what are they doing? Is it more of the same stuff that didn't work in the first place? There's more to it than that, and I think we kind of slide over that. But we're running out of time here. Senator Bonhoff is waiting, and I think there. I don't know if there's anybody in the audience that.
Madam Chair, I didn't get all my questions answered.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry. I didn't get those questions answered about incentives and achievement gap. And I will just say on the tutoring, just because the tutoring was ineffective, means that we didn't have very good controls on the tutoring. And I don't know that that's a reason to say we would no longer allow low-income parents to have that option. I think that just shows that we didn't do a very good job of controlling that. And quite frankly, saying that we're going to have a school district tutor a child that has already been teaching that child, and for some reason there's been an issue, I think can be may be the solution, but on the other hand, they may need that outside tutoring, and I just want to reiterate I'm concerned about that. But incentives, tell me
sure.
about incentives.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, as for incentives, I would go back to what the Deputy Commissioner referenced earlier, that in our conversations with stakeholders throughout this, the idea that we're finally going to be recognizing schools for high performance, whether it's our reward schools or our celebration schools, they have said public recognition would mean a great deal. The way I like to explain it is that nobody right now holds a ticker tape parade because you made adequate early progress. It's a pretty blasé term. It doesn't get anyone all that excited. Being a reward school or a celebration school, we believe from what we've heard, will be something that that schools will strive for, and they will consider an incentive. And I would go back to what we said to Senator Cruz about the looking for opportunities for financial rewards that could act as incentives. Finally, to the achievement gap question, certainly as we spoke to earlier in the growth model, looking at students who are performing high, what has been the incentive previously for schools to continue to work with those students, and under No Child Left Behind there really has not been one. We believe that the type of growth model that we are using, because it looks at the growth of all students, not just students who are below proficient or right around proficient, but students who are well above proficient as well, that creates more incentive to focus on the achievement, not just of the bubble kids, but of all kids, regardless of where they come in. One thing that would aid us in that we do not have the ability to do right now under federal law is to do an assessment system that goes above grade level, an adaptive testing system, so that if you're in third grade and you're just, you know, reading it at a seventh grade level, you just keep getting more and more difficult questions outside of grade level. That would help us more accurately measure growth amongst those high-performing students. We don't have that ability right now. It's been something that's been discussed in Washington in the reauthorization debate, so it's possible that would be coming down the line in the future.
Madam Chair, just one final comment, please. And then I'll
Wrap it up quickly here.
Yes. But I think I heard you tell me that public recognition is more important to schools than loss of funding. I don't think that's what you meant to say, but that's how it translated.
Not loss of funding. I don't think they ever referred to that. Commissioner Montano.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator. No, I said that public recognition, if there's no monetary reward, a lot of times public recognition is very meaningful to them, even if we don't have funding. But I think that I'd like to add to that that we'd be very happy to work with Senator Nelson to see if there are other ways that we could reward these schools. I mean, certainly public recognition is one, but we're very open to working with it to see if there are other ways, you know, while we seek monetary reward for them, if there are other ways. The other thing I wanted to add in her concern about parent information, our new website has a whole section dedicated to parents, and we're very, very in tune with the fact that we need to give information out to parents in such a way that is very meaningful and understanding to them, and that is a real primary focus of our communication section. Is there's a whole section in our new web that's just geared specifically to parents, and we've been meeting with parent groups. We know what they're looking for. We know what they want, and rest assured we will have information there that is meaningful to them and that they can use.
Good. Thank you. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what you're hearing around the table is an echoing of some of the concerns I've made to you, Mr. Moore, previously, and that we in this committee seem to have a strong preference for being able to measure growth against a standard. And I don't think that it's against just proficiency so that it's like if you're down here, we don't want to recognize the progress. I think it's more of what is expected in a year's growth. We want to know, did that student make a year's growth or did they make a year and a half's growth, but not against a comparative, but rather to what we've established as a standard various grade levels. And with your comment, and first of all, I think you've done an unbelievable job, and I'm so impressed with your professionalism, the detail, the theory, all that you've put into it. So please hear our concerns, as we do want to be your partners and be part of it, and we want to feel as though this is something we embrace. And so I think consistently what you'd have to take away with is that we want to have a more adaptive type growth model rather than to norm. And, you know, I don't know if you'll change it or you won't, but that really is what we seem to prefer. And so I just don't want to back away from that. I want to clear. And by the way, I think the way, Mr. Moore, you described your achievement gap measure with your statistical model, great. No quarrel with it. Leave that just that way. That makes total sense, distinct from what we're asking for on the growth part. I would go echo what Chair Olson said with regard to the top 15%, the bottom 5%. That didn't make any sense to me. To me, if we have goals, we should reward those top ones that are achieving our goals. If they're not, then they're in our bottom, and you can sequentially dictate how far below based on rank. But if they're great, they're great. So I would hate, I don't believe in the bell curve thing. If I was a teacher and they were all A's, they're all A's. I don't have to give them F's because somebody has to get an F. So that was the other thing. And then lastly, with regard to the tutoring, I don't know if you've ever read the legislative auditor's report around our alternative extended day programs, but it was the most clear indication, according to the legislative auditor's report, that we've ever seen that showed actual improvement in scores based on extended day alternative programs. And so while your SES might, if that's the right term, may not be effective, that one is off the charts. And so rather than just throw out the tutoring, if there's some way to utilize the best practices of those extended day programs that are working, and I would ask you to go back and read that OLA report and see if there isn't some way to expand that statewide for at-risk students. That was a mouthful, but I was quick.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
I don't know if you need to respond. I think she was just giving you some orders, and we we'll appreciate that you respond to the. Yes, Mr. Moore.
Madam Chair.
Or is it Dr. Moore?
It's almost Dr. Moore.
Okay.
It's still Mr. Madam Chair, Senator, I would like to say that in our application, if you, I think you've received it with today, we have growth to proficiency targets clearly labeled in the in there. It's a big document. You know, we can point it out to you if you'd like. But we did a study, and we have very clear targets that we intend to communicate to schools about what it takes for a student who is at the lowest achievement level does not meet in order to get to proficiency. Also, what it takes for a student who's at the exceeds level or that already meets proficiency. What kind of growth does that student need to exhibit in order to remain proficient? So we have those targets in there, and we intend to use them for technical assistance and to clearly communicate that expectation that growth has to be tied to standards. And so hopefully that answers your question. With regards to the top 15%, the bottom 5%, and then the 10% focus schools, those are required by the ESEA flexibility option, the way that was given to us. So we have to do a very fine-grained differentiation that allows for us to identify with respect to those requirements.
And Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, the reasoning, I think, from what we've been told by the Department of Education, that they've set that 5%, 10%, so on, is a recognition that there are limited resources for these things. Certainly the federal funding that we receive for school improvement and AYP improvement is limited, and by all accounts is going to be more limited in the future. We think that by focusing on that, the bottom 5% and that next 10% is with our school improvement activities, we're really going to be able to make the most difference there, and that's the best way to leverage our federal funding. So we do think that will be an effective way for us to be more efficient with our resources.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to raise a question or have some testimony? Yes, sir.
Madam Chair.
You'd have to come to a mic and identify yourself.
I'm Greg O'Connor with the Education Liberty Watch, and I did have some remarks to make, but I know you're short on time.
Yeah, we've lost your audience, but if you've got a succinct.
I would like to present it to the full committee, so I'd be happy to come back at a future meeting.
Okay, just in response to this.
Having to do with waivers, No Child Left Behind, these issues.
Okay, I'm not sure how much more time we're going to have a short session, so can you succinctly add?
I would prefer to come back before the full committee.
Well, I'm not sure that opportunity is going to be there. That's why if you have some basic message you'd like to share with us right now, it would be
Not
be
something
on record.
I can say in 6